and Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
KQED traffic at 4:59 starts with better news in San Leandro. Here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, they finally did clear that overturned Army truck on East 580 at 164th Avenue. It's been out there since about 2 o'clock, looking better back into Oakland. Trouble on the Sunol Grade, big rig and a car got into it, North 680 before Sheridan Road. They're not blocking lanes, but it's slow anyway from Automall Parkway. Getting word of a car fire, Richmond eastbound 80 before a Hilltop. You'll see that in the second lane for the left. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Kia Summer Event now through July 8th, offering a selection of Kia EVs, SUVs, and sedans. More info at Kia.com. Kia, movement that inspires. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento at 5 o'clock.
This is a great labor market if you already have a job. It is quite a tough market if you're just starting out and don't yet have experience.
Employers added far more jobs last month than forecasters expected.
We'll give you the latest on the economy this Friday, June 7th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Recent elections in several Latin American countries could mean a change in immigration policy for the U.S.
Mexico is no longer just a transit country for migrants. It is now a destination.
Also, oil wells that don't pump oil anymore are still causing pollution, and that is contributing to climate change.
And believe it or not, cassette tapes are making a comeback.
We'll meet a family-run company in Missouri that's driving the revival.
As long as tape is popular and selling and people want it, I mean, we're planning on doing it.
Those stories after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Russia's war in Ukraine was the focus today in the French capital when President Biden sat down with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. NPR's Tamara Keith in Paris says Biden's remarks included an apology.
President Biden apologized to Zelensky for the recent aid package to Ukraine taking months to be approved by Congress.
But we got it done finally, and since then, including today, I've announced six packages of significant funding. Today, I'm also signing an additional package for $225 million.
Zelensky said today's meeting would get into military strategy, but was also symbolic.
It's very important that you stay with us. This bipartisan support with the Congress, it's very important that in this unity, United States, America, all American people stay with Ukraine.
We're still in completely, said Biden. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Paris.
Vice President Kamala Harris held an organizing call with young activists today focused on gun violence prevention. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, it's an issue Harris has championed during the Biden administration. It's also a key part of the campaign's outreach to younger voters.
Harris ended the week on the campaign trail, marking Gun Violence Awareness Day. And in remarks over Zoom, Harris once again called for an assault weapons ban and universal background checks. She also urged young people to get involved.
The most effective movements in our nation that have been about progress have been fueled by young leaders.
Harris has been a leading voice in the campaign's push to engage with younger voters who have come of age during a time of increased gun violence in schools. Voters under 30 were a crucial part of President Biden's winning coalition 4 years ago, and the campaign is continuing to court those votes again. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The main shipping channel to the port of Baltimore is set to reopen this weekend. NPR's Joel Rose reports crews have finished removing the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Salvage crews have been working for more than 2 months to remove debris from the collapsed bridge. They finally took out the last major steel truss that was blocking the shipping channel this week. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had opened a smaller temporary channel for ships to get in and out of Baltimore's port. Now the full channel will be open for the first time in nearly 11 weeks since a massive container ship lost power and crashed into one of the bridge's supporting columns, killing six construction workers and halting most maritime traffic into the port. A replacement for Baltimore's Key Bridge will take years to build at an expected cost of nearly $2 billion. Joel Rose, NPR News.
New vehicles sold in the U.S. currently average around 29 miles per gallon in real-world driving, but in less than a decade, the Biden administration wants to up that mark. By 2031, the administration proposing new vehicles average 38 miles per gallon. On Wall Street today, the Dow is down 87 points. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Tara Seiler. A Superior Court judge today granted a temporary restraining order to the University of California, temporarily halting a system-wide strike by thousands of academic workers who walked out over UC's response to Palestinian protesters. Today's action follows two failed requests by UC to have state labor regulators halt the strike. Rafael Jaime is president of UAW 4811.
We expected the University of California to respect the agency that has the prerogative over labor issues. And, you know, instead they went to a judge in Orange County. And so we are surprised.
Jaime said the order does not mean the strike was ruled illegal. In a statement, UC said it is extremely grateful for a pause in the strike so students can complete their academic studies. Both sides are vowing to continue to pursue unfair labor practice claims against the other. Night markets are coming to San Francisco's Richmond District starting this evening. Four Heart of the Richmond District night markets will be held on Clement Street this summer between 22nd and 25th Avenues, including tonight's event. The markets, featuring food and other vendors, games, and performances, are part of a growing trend of events meant to draw residents out in the evening. San Francisco's Chinatown hosts night markets every second Friday. The Sunset District will see its night market return in the fall. And a new market launched in West Oakland last night. I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. And from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. The Bay Area will be partly cloudy tonight with haze and lows in the 50s. Clouds will linger tomorrow, but Sunday afternoon will be sunny. Bay Area highs will be in the 60s at the coast tomorrow and in the 70s inland. The forecast high for Sacramento tomorrow is 88.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Let's talk jobs. U.S. businesses did a lot more hiring last month than forecasters had expected. You see, analysts were expecting some slowdown in the job market, but if anything, it seems to be revving up. That's good for workers, of course, but it could make it more difficult for the Federal Reserve to control inflation. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to explain. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so how loud is that revving sound from the job market?
It's pretty loud. The Labor Department said this morning employers added 272,000 jobs in May, lots more than had been predicted. There were lots of jobs added in healthcare and restaurants and retail and education, really across the board. Almost every industry was hiring, even construction and manufacturing, which typically struggle when interest rates are as high as they are right now. Hmm. For almost 2 years now, the economy's been adding an average of about 250,000 jobs month after month. Julia Pollack, who's chief economist at the job search website ZipRecruiter, says not only are more people working, but their paychecks are getting bigger as well.
Nice. Workers have now seen a full year of real wage growth, and that is propping up consumer demand and spending, and it's sort of buoying confidence among businesses.
Average wages in May were up 4.1% from a year ago, which should be more than enough to keep pace with prices. It's kind of a virtuous cycle where more people are working, earning money, spending money, and then that creates demand for more workers.
Okay, that sounds awesome, but I have to ask, is there any bad news in this morning's report?
Yeah, the government does two surveys every month. They first ask employers how many people are on the payroll. That's where the jobs numbers come from. They also ask individuals if they're working or looking for work. And that second survey paints a less rosy picture of the job market. It found fewer people were working last month than the month before. and the unemployment rate inched up from 3.9 to 4%. Mm. Now, Pollack notes almost all that increase in unemployment came from young people under 25, some of whom were probably just getting out of school last month.
So I think this is a great labor market if you already have a job. It is quite a tough market if you're just starting out and don't yet have experience.
Now, even at 4%, unemployment is still very low by historical standards, but it has been creeping up in recent months, and if that continues, it could put the Federal Reserve in a bit of a pickle.
Wait, why is that?
Well, the Fed, as we often say, has two goals, fight inflation and keep as many people working as they can. For the last couple of years, employment's been so strong, the Fed's been able to focus all of its attention on getting inflation under control by raising interest rates. So far, those high interest rates have not triggered any big spike in unemployment, but if the labor market starts to weaken, well, the Fed's going to face increased pressure to let up off the brake and lower those interest rates. Today, we got these kind of mixed signals where the unemployment rate does suggest some weakening, but the jobs number says, no, 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 this is an economy that's still going strong. So, you know, the Fed's got its work cut out for it.
Wait, so which way is the Fed leaning at this point?
For right now, the central bank is keeping its eye on inflation, and it's keeping interest rates high. That means it's more expensive to get a car loan or carry a balance on your credit card. Fed policymakers are set to meet next week, and they are widely expected to hold interest rates steady at that meeting and probably their July meeting as well. Investors still think there's a chance the Fed will cut interest rates at the September meeting. But after today's report, they're a little less confident about that.
Hmm. That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
All across America, there are old oil wells that are no longer pumping oil, but they can still release pollution, contaminating water and air, and contributing to climate change. It is a multi-billion dollar problem. One challenge is getting money to plug these wells. Another, as NPR's Camila Domonoske reports, is just finding them.
Oil wells are supposed to be closed at the end of their lives, plugged up with cement. But many never were, just left unplugged with no one responsible for them. How many? More than 100,000 the government knows about, and if you count the ones they don't, Dan Arthur is a petroleum engineer who's thought about these wells for decades.
I would say as far as total orphan wells, it's probably more like 1.5 million.
Orphan wells. They stretch from California to New York on ranches and farms and near schools and houses where they may leak oil or other harmful pollutants into the local water or air. And because oil is often mixed with methane, a potent greenhouse gas, they contribute to climate change, maybe as much as 2 million cars do. I rode shotgun in Arthur's pickup when he and his stepson Carter went out to hunt orphan wells for spring break. Arthur works on orphan well projects, but this is also something they do for fun.
Carter, keep your eyes peeled, you know, for if you see any other wells or anything like that.
Carter's 13, and when we set off, he almost immediately spots an old well on the side of the road. I don't see it. Where?
By the fire hydrant right there.
That pipe just sticking up?
Yep.
That's an orphan well.
Oh my gosh. It may not be a typical spring break activity, but lots of groups are hunting for these wells. Government and tribal agencies, academics and nonprofits and companies all poring over historical photos, looking with drones and airplanes, with magnetometers and machine learning. The Environmental Defense Fund just launched a satellite that might help spot some. And of course...
So we're going to scoot by the buffalo here.
There's the boots on the ground method.
So how do you find them? How do you know? You got to go get your ass out and find them.
We're driving through a prairie preserve near Tulsa, Oklahoma. The air smells like smoke from nearby brush fires, and on rolling hills covered with native grasses, bison are roaming around.
You want to get out and pet it, Carter?
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
Why not?
We will not let you.
The bison are more dangerous than they look. We're in Osage County. 100 years ago, there was an oil boom, and white people murdered many members of the Osage tribe to steal their oil wealth. Maybe you saw Killers of the Flower Moon. A few of the wells drilled in that bloody time are still pumping. Many others are just relics left unplugged. Along with wells drilled in more recent decades, they all pierce the landscape.
Oh.
What do you see?
So... What I spotted here is what appears to be an orphan well. maybe a couple of orphan wells. So let's get out and take a look.
Watch out for buffalo poop.
We find a couple of pipes sticking out of the ground with little metal caps on top. They're obviously not producing oil. They're not permanently plugged either. They're just there. Later, I track down the guy who drilled these wells, Shane Mattson. These are not century-old wells. They do show up on maps. Mattson remembers drilling them specifically.
Oh, yeah, I remember. That was one of my favorites. It's a spectacular, very fascinating well.
He was driving from Texas to Oklahoma when we talked. He signed them over to a former business partner a decade ago during a very rough time for the oil industry, particularly in Osage County. Old wells often get sold off.
And I'm not sure who controls those assets now.
And this is a key question. Identifying orphan wells isn't just about locating a well. You also have to determine if anyone is still liable for plugging costs. And that's a very important question, because plugging a well is expensive.
I have spent as low as $20,000 and as high as $300,000.
Everett Waller is the chair of the Osage Minerals Council. He made a big push to close orphan wells on the tribe's land. Now, remember, companies are supposed to plug wells when they're done, and they're also supposed to put up money in advance to cover the costs if they don't, like if they go bankrupt with open wells. One way to do it is with a surety bond, money that would help cover costs if a well is orphaned. The problem is...
the monies on the bonds are not sufficient enough to plug one well, much less a lease with 10 wells on it.
This is not a new problem. Oil companies have put off plugging wells and gone bankrupt and left them orphaned for as long as there's been an oil industry. But it's getting new attention across the country, in part because of rising concerns about climate change. One of Dan Arthur's employees, Daniel Caldwell, is with us, operating an expensive camera that makes invisible gas leaks visible. The wells look good. They're not leaking. But some old tanks that used to be connected to them...
Okay, yeah, see... where the hatch is, I think there's a plume.
Caldwell zooms in, and Arthur and I take a peek through the camera.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, there's a little bit,
just
a
little
color.
Yeah, you can kind of see kind of moving upward and kind of away.
A little stream of planet-warming gases rising up into the air. Methane is far more potent than carbon dioxide. Some wells leak more methane, others less, and overall, agriculture, landfills, active oil and gas production, they all release more. But there are a lot of orphan wells. And unlike farms or active oil wells, they don't benefit anybody. They don't make food or energy or money. There's no reason for them to be open, except the fact that they're expensive to close. And as Arthur explained after our trip, that's a problem for more than the climate.
So these wells can impact people, the environment, groundwater, surface water, soils, all these different things over time. And, you know, it's frustrating for me because a lot of people don't see them.
And if you don't see them, you don't know there's a problem to solve. Right now, there's a mix of carrots and sticks to try to prevent companies from orphaning wells in the first place. And the Biden administration is spending billions on orphan wells, enough to plug some of the wells that are out there. At least some of the ones we know about. Camila Domonoske, NPR News, Pawhuska, Oklahoma.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Cassette tapes are making a comeback. That story is ahead in the next segment of All Things Considered after a traffic update starting in Richmond. Here's Julie Depesh.
Dealing with that car fire, it's eastbound 80 before Hilltop Drive, still blocking the second lane for the left, and heavy backup to Cutting. A little trouble in Petaluma, South 101, the off-ramp to Lakeville Highway. We've got a stalled transportation bus blocking that off-ramp. And in San Jose, it's a hit-and-run crash eastbound 237 before 1st Street. That's in the second lane for the left, and heavy backup to Great America Parkway. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Symphony. Sheku Kane Mason performs Shostakovich's Cello Concerto No. 1, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen, June 13th to 15th. Tickets available at sfsymphony.org and from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and XFi Pod that extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
I'm crushing on me.
You call them self-love pop bangers?
Yeah, self-love anthems, yes.
All about what motivates Meghan Trainor.
I write these anthems for myself, but also for strangers out there.
Meghan Trainor's new album, Timeless, and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition. Weekend Edition starts at 5 a.m. here on KQED Public Radio.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Tom Papa was not impressed with the new CEO power move, not drinking coffee.
Can you imagine walking in line at Starbucks just to get to the front and say, nothing for me, thank you?
I'm Peter Sagal. Do whatever you have to do to stay alert for this week's show with special guest radio superstar Charlemagne the God. That's the news quiz from NPR.
Tune in for the news quiz tomorrow morning at 11 or catch the rebroadcast tomorrow night at 6. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The NBA Finals got underway in Boston last night, and let me tell you, it was a great night to be a Celtics fan. Boston thumped the Dallas Mavericks 107-89 in Game 1 of the Best of 7 series. There is a whole lot at stake for both teams, and joining us now to break it all down is Esteban Bustillos with member station GBH in Boston. Hey there.
Hi, Juana.
All right, so you were covering this game. Tell us what the scene was like last night at the arena.
Yeah, so there's a lot of energy in the building, TD Garden in Boston. Now, for Boston, they lost the finals in 2022 and 2010. They last won in 2008, so there's a lot of anticipation for finals victory. But they've got the Dallas Mavericks in their way. Now, the Mavs, maybe the hottest team of the playoffs, and that franchise's one and only championship came in 2011. So listen, they're hungry too. But last night, Boston landed a solid first punch, beating the Mavs easily, but Celtics star Jaylen Brown, he wasn't satisfied with just one win.
You can't be celebrating ourselves. Dallas is, you know, probably getting ready for the next game right now, so we got to prepare and get ready for the next one too.
Okay, and as you mentioned, the last time the Celtics won a title was back in 2008, so how much pressure is there on this Boston team in the series?
Yeah, so listen, let's remember, Boston has a total of 17 titles. Now, that's tied for the most ever in the NBA with the Los Angeles Lakers, their rival. So they desperately want to pull ahead and own the record outright. Now, this current Celtics core, led by Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, they've done pretty much everything except win that elusive title. And last year, they lost in the Eastern Conference Finals. And Boston, listen, those NBA championship banners, that's all anyone cares about. And Jason Tatum admitted after the game that he was a bit nervous heading into Game 1.
It's surreal being in the finals. And, you know, when you're young, I guess in your career, you think you're always going to go back. And last year was kind of like a wake-up call when we didn't make it. So, you know, getting back to this point and being here is really a big deal.
And Juana, listen, now, that team is 3 wins away from their ultimate goal, but let's not forget Dallas is a really good team.
That they are, and a whole lot has been made about Dallas guard Kyrie Irving. He used to play for Boston, and we'll just say he left under not the best of terms. What was the reception like for him in Game 1?
Yeah, pretty much he got booed every time he touched the ball. Here's the sound of how the crowd reacted when he was introduced.
Number 11,
But after the game, Irving was taking everything in stride.
You know, I thought it was going to be a little louder in here, but I'm expecting the same things going into game two. Crowd trying to get me out of my element, my teammates out of my element. But again, the energy's got to be focused towards the game.
Now listen, this loss is not how Dallas wanted to start these finals, but the Mavericks have bounced back in the playoffs before, and they definitely shouldn't be counted out.
Okay, Celtics lead 1-0. Where's the series go from here?
Right. It's a good first punch from Boston, but don't expect the rest of this series to be this wide open. Now, Celtics big man Kristaps Porzingis, he was a big factor. This was his first game back since the first round. If he can stay healthy, Boston looks good. But listen, Dallas's star duo of Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving have proved a lot of people wrong. Expect them to make this a competitive series. And look, it's really fun. This is Luka Doncic's first NBA Finals. He's going to be one of the best players ever when it's all said and done. Game two is Sunday, so want to get your popcorn ready. Get the butter, salt, all that. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to be watching. That was Esteban Bustillos from member station GBH in Boston talking to us about the NBA Finals. Thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
Decades ago, a commercial for high-quality cassette tapes featured jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald.
Can the amplified voice of Ella Fitzgerald shatter this glass? Now we ask, is it live or is it Memorex?
That catchphrase persisted, but the cassette tape? Well, less so. Cassettes, though, are making a small comeback, thanks in part to a family-run company in southern Missouri. Suzanne Hogan of member station KCUR reports.
It might be a surprise to hear that cassette tapes are even around anymore. Formats like CDs, MP3s, and downloading and streaming audio have drastically changed the way we consume music. But similar to vinyl records, there's been a resurgence in analog cassette tapes. According to Billboard magazine, sales have grown more than 440% in the past decade. One of the drivers behind this trend is National Audio Company, a staple in the industry for over 50 years. And one of its signature cassette releases is a well-known Disney classic. Star Wars: The Force Awakens is among the thousands of tapes the company has produced. National Audio got its start in 1968, just a few years after the cassette tape was invented. Vice President Phil Stepp, whose late grandfather was the founder, says their family business has stood by the cassette through all the industry ups and downs.
As long as tape is popular and selling and people want it, I mean, we're planning on doing it.
Phil's father, President Steve Stepp, says as cassettes gained popularity in the 80s, the company was doing well in dubbing and duplications, and a new invention was a big help. The portable Walkman cassette player made it convenient to listen to music on the go. By the mid-1980s, Billboard reported cassettes were selling better than vinyl records. But it was also in the 80s that the cassette tape's nemesis hit the scene.
Philips announced the next best thing to live music, compact disc.
The rise of the CD did bury some companies, but not National Audio, because it wasn't dubbing music cassettes. It made books on tape and spoken word products. Steve Stepp says the company kept chugging along, acquiring unwanted equipment from companies who were leaving the industry.
Everybody thought we were crazy. That's still true. Everybody still thinks we're crazy.
In the early 2000s, their company started fulfilling more music orders from mainstream acts like Pearl Jam and the Smashing Pumpkins, who were still releasing cassettes. And for independent musicians, National Audio Company became a vital resource because cassettes were the affordable option for underground artists who wanted to release music on their own terms and in smaller quantities.
We're dealing with about 5,000 independent labels worldwide.
But a major industry shakeup in the 2010s almost ended National Audio. It was in the business of making cassettes in-house, but that didn't include the actual magnetic tape inside the cartridges. At the time, most big companies making the tape had pulled the plug. Supply was running out. To solve the problem, the company turned to its vice president, Phil Stepp, a chemist and former neuroscience professor. He and a team devised a recipe, process, and machinery to make music-quality magnetic tape. It is a very complicated process that involves getting material from all over the world. And it took years of trial and error to figure it out. On a recent tour of the assembly line, Phil Stepp shows off all the new and old technology.
This is a tape coating line. This is the base film right here. And it's a little thicker than shrink wrap.
Belts and pulleys, large ovens, an old cigarette wrapping machine. There's a lot going on. Now the company is at a point where it's ahead on tape production. Steve Stepp says they crank out about 30 million cassette tapes a year, making National Audio Company one of the largest cassette tape manufacturers in the world. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan in Kansas City.
This is NPR News.
KQED traffic at 529 starts with trouble in San Jose. Here's Julie Deppish.
That's a big crash on the eastbound 237 before 1st Street. A hit run is blocking the second lane for the left. That's a backup starting at Great America Parkway. We'll stay in the South Bay, northbound 280 after Ray Street. A three-car wreck, right lane blocked, a little slow from Guadalupe Parkway. And still trying to clear this car fire, Richmond, eastbound 80 before Hilltop Drive. It's been in the middle lane, very heavy from cutting. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. Listeners can explore their brews at wherever fine beverages are sold and learn how trailblazing runs in the family by visiting sierranevada.com. This is KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highland, Sacramento. It's 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin on reimagining songs from her recent album and coming back to the sax after a jaw injury.
Whenever I feel fear, I know it's the right road. Every time I do something that's impossible and it happens, you get a little stamp of like, oh, that kind of worked.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Biden used the second day of commemorations of D-Day in France to rally Americans in defense of democracy, something the president says is under threat from his Republican rival in the November presidential election. Meanwhile, NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Normandy, where the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion that helped end World War II in Europe continues.
We're June 7th, and the celebrations of the 80th anniversary of D-Day are still going on across all these little towns along the Normandy coast, Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer, where the international ceremony was yesterday. And today they're having music groups from the U.S. perform, and everyone is out on Omaha Beach, and it's still a big celebration all week here in Normandy.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. President Biden, meanwhile, also met with Ukraine's president in Paris, where he apologized to Zelensky for the months it took to get the latest aid package approved by Congress. Well, summer is still weeks away, but a dangerous heat dome is trapping millions of folks in the Southwest. NPR's Amy Held tells us temperatures are up to 30 degrees above average for this time of year in some places.
The desert Southwest knows heat, but this heat is different. It came on fast. Glenn Simpson, senior director at Community Ambulance in Nevada, says that's led to more heat-related emergencies for residents.
Locals just aren't used to it. So even though they may have grown up here, their bodies haven't acclimated to that.
Some are more vulnerable.
Those that are unhoused, to the elderly, to children, to those that may have chronic health conditions.
In Phoenix, first responders have a new protocol, putting heat stroke patients in cold water immersion bags. Last year was the hottest on record globally. Now, planet-warming carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has hit a new record, largely from fossil fuel burning. Amy Held, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished the week lower across the board on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Tara Seiler. The antiviral drug Paxlovid shows no clear signs of helping patients with long COVID. That's according to a two-year clinical trial out of Stanford. KQED's Keith Mizuguchi reports.
Researchers gave a 15-day course of Paxlovid to participants. That's three times longer than what's normally prescribed for people with acute COVID. The hope was that the extended period would help relieve symptoms for long COVID patients. Dr. Upinder Singh was one of the lead researchers.
To me, the study shouldn't be seen as Paxlovid doesn't work. It should be seen as saying, in this early small study, a large benefit was not seen. in a patient population that had had symptoms for a long time and that was largely vaccinated.
Singh notes that Paxlovid could still reduce long COVID symptoms in some people. There's still no FDA-approved treatments for long COVID. I'm Keith Mizuguchi, KQED News.
Community organizers in San Francisco are calling on city leaders to condemn what they call ongoing racist attacks on local Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim communities. That's after two Clarion Alley murals commemorating Palestinians were defaced this week. Chris Ghazala is a Palestinian artist who contributed to one of the murals, which included the faces of Palestinian journalists, activists, and civilians who have been killed. The words "Stop Terrorism" and "Stop Hamas" were spray painted over the faces on that mural.
All my time goes to fixing my murals. I don't have time to like create new stuff, and I'm drained, you know?
Ghazala says his murals featuring Palestinians have been defaced multiple times, especially in recent months. I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from Kinetic Creations at Curiosity in San Mateo, a new interactive exhibition for kids of all ages where art and science collide. More at curiosity.org. From UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health to deliver exceptional orthopedic care in the North Bay, leading specialists in arthritis, joint replacement, spine, hand, elbow, and more, ucsfhealth.org/marinhealth. And from SF MoMA, welcoming music lovers to celebrate 100 years of music and design, Art of Noise features over 800 works from rock posters to hi-fi listening experiences. On view now, more at sfmoma.org. And support for NPR comes from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find restaurants that cater meetings and events with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. From Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness and the listeners of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Biden administration has been ramping up its efforts to curb undocumented immigration at the U.S. southern border, and it has been counting on support from the governments of Mexico and Central America, where several major presidential elections could impact the flow of migrants to the U.S. NPR's Jasmine Garst joins us to discuss. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Jasmine, earlier this week, President Biden announced executive actions that would increase deportations of undocumented migrants seeking asylum at the border. Mexico has a newly elected president, Claudia Sheinbaum. What's her stance?
So Mexico has collaborated with the U.S. on immigration for decades. Current President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been accepting deportees and deployed the Mexican National Guard to police migration. Newly elected President Sheinbaum is expected to keep collaborating. Here's Lila Abed of the Wilson Center.
It's important to note that while migration continues to be a priority on the bilateral agenda, it now is also a priority for Mexico. And that's because Mexico is no longer just a transit country for migrants. It is now a destination.
And Sheinbaum has said to stop immigration, root causes like poverty have to be addressed.
Right. Okay, let's turn now to Central America. There have been recent elections there, too. What can you tell us about those?
Panama recently elected President José Raúl Mulino, who has vowed to close the Darien Gap. That's the jungle region that migrants trek through to get to the U.S. The other major election this year was El Salvador. President Nayib Bukele was reelected. And the U.S. has had an uneasy relationship with the self-described world's coolest dictator. But the last week, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas attended his presidential inauguration ceremony. I spoke to Roman Gressier from the newspaper El Faro in English, and he says the Biden administration has shifted.
We're not getting in the mud on the issue of unconstitutional reelection, and we are stressing migration cooperation and economic cooperation.
A clear message about priorities.
So, Jasmine, so far you've told us about elections and the government perspectives, but I'm interested in hearing about the people who actually choose to make the journey.
Look, we know that deterrence alone doesn't work long term. I want to point you to another major presidential election coming up, end of July in Venezuela. Venezuela is going through a severe humanitarian crisis, around 7.7 million migrants and refugees as of last year. And you know, this week, after the president's executive actions, I kept thinking about a Venezuelan mom I spoke to recently at a New York shelter, Stephanie. She asked that we withhold her last name because she was sexually assaulted en route.
Ahorita criar un niño en Venezuela es muy difícil. Porque uno puede conseguir el almuerzo, pero tú no consigues la cena. Entonces, si tú desayunas, no almuerzas.
So she told me back home, every day she had to make this choice. Feed her kid lunch or dinner. And she tried to live in Colombia and Ecuador, and eventually she got desperate and made the journey to the U.S. And so there's this huge amount of pressure for Latin American countries to enforce immigration, but the reasons people like Stephanie are leaving remain.
NPR's Jasmine Garis, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
When ChatGPT came out a year and a half ago, big school districts like LA Unified rushed to block the tool amid fears that students would use it to cheat. Well, now many districts have reversed or softened those bans, and they're embracing AI more broadly. For example, LA Unified just launched its own AI-powered chatbot this spring. It's called Ed. Other districts in California are using AI-driven tools to grade papers or to give students feedback on their writing. But there is little state regulation or oversight, as Kari Johnson recently reported for Cal Matters. Welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. So I know that you talked to a few teachers in California who are using AI to not only grade papers and assess students' writing, but also to give feedback, right? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, so when a student turns in a paper, you know, the teacher can run it through a system. You know, for example, one of the teachers who I spoke with, Jen Roberts, is an English teacher from Point Loma High School in San Diego, and she would use a tool called Writable. And so she would put the writing from a student into the system, and it would provide analysis based on her grading rubric, and then about a paragraph of feedback per student, and she will go through and review the grade and the feedback before handing that back to the student.
And how much do the students know that the feedback they're getting in many cases is computer generated?
Oh, they're well aware. And, you know, I think one of the main, you know, parts of guidelines that the California Department of Education has released on use of AI is to use it in a transparent way and to have conversations with students about when it's okay and not okay to use the technology, similar to a calculator in a math class.
Right. Okay, so I get why this would be helpful for teachers. Obviously, AI can help save them a lot of time. But did these teachers talk to you about how these tools are actually affecting their students' performance?
Yeah. So the teachers that I spoke with who have used AI in their classroom over the course of the past school year said that their ability to assign writing assignments quicker, because they were getting feedback quicker by using AI, they were able to give more writing assignments to their students. And they described it as a kind of a virtuous process, that it led to improvements in their students' writing.
Okay. But I have a question, because even though the state may be issuing guidelines on how educators should use AI, the state does not track AI use among school districts, right? So how do we know if these tools are truly helping or maybe in some cases harming student performance more broadly?
We genuinely do not. And while, you know, the teachers that I spoke with said that it definitely saves them time, one teacher even described it as feeling like the feedback that she was getting from GPT-4 felt like the AI was like in her brain.
Oh,
you
God.
Know, they also described that in some instances that it was returning grades that were not consistent with the type of grade that they would give.
Which seems so unfair, because grades are huge when it comes to getting into certain colleges.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the AI regulatory regime that is emerging in a lot of places says that higher scrutiny should be placed on AI models, with the possibility of having adverse impact on people's lives. And this seems like it could potentially fit that description.
That is Kari Johnson, tech reporter for Cal Matters. His piece is called California Teachers Are Using AI to Grade Papers. Who's grading the AI? Thank you so much for joining us, Kari.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. When you eat a tasty fish fillet, what happens to the rest of the fish? Well, a group of companies in Iceland has an answer. They use nearly 100% of the fish. Some commercial fisheries in the Great Lakes are trying to do the same, and they hope it will revive their industry. Dan Wanshura from Interlaken Public Radio reports.
Leland, Michigan is a quaint town, population about 400. It sits on the eastern edge of Lake Michigan and is home to Fishtown, a historic collection of small fishing shanties. Carlson's Fishery is located in one of them, a shop that's been selling directly to customers for 120 years. This day, a local fisherman just brought in about 1,700 pounds of fresh whitefish.
They are gorgeous.
Jimber Snyder, a big guy in bright yellow waterproof bibs and a blue bandana tied around his head, is filleting the fish.
You're going to find anything much better looking than this. It was swimming this morning.
Burr Snyder tosses the whitefish fillet on a pile on a table in front of him. Then he slides the rest of the fish, about half of it, into a big rubber garbage bin. Just a few years ago, Carlson's wasn't doing anything with those fish scraps. They were dumped in a landfill. Dave Nafsker says that's been pretty common for the entire Great Lakes. He heads an intergovernmental organization that's behind an effort to get the Great Lakes commercial fishery to use 100% of each fish caught.
Our fishery has for decades, maybe centuries, not really truly been a fishery, but rather a fillet production industry.
The current value of an average Great Lakes whitefish is around $15. Nafsker thinks it's realistic to double, even triple that amount in the next several years by using more of each fish. He hopes the Great Lakes fishery can find the same success that a group called the Iceland Ocean Cluster has. So he traveled thousands of miles to meet the founder.
Walked into his office. He had a fish skin, fish leather lamp that was a piece of art hanging. And he had a table with all these different products that were being made from parts of the Icelandic cod that used to be put in landfill.
Inspired by that meeting, Nafsker started the Great Lakes 100% Fish Pledge when he returned home. His team began by sending whitefish to Iceland for biotechnical testing to see what other products they might be used for.
They identified things like fish leather from the skin, collagen that could be made from the skin and from the scales, fish meal and oil that can be made from the viscera or the guts, and a couple of other products as well.
There's been similar testing for other Great Lakes fish, like walleye, lake trout, and yellow perch. They've got big goals for them, too. Back at Carlson's Fishery, co-owner Mike Berta is spraying the fillets down with water. He says for the past few years, Carlson's has avoided landfilling its fish scraps. Instead, they've brought them to the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians for composting. It's putting the rest of the fish to good use, but for Carlson's, there's no money involved. Berta is optimistic the 100% Great Lakes Fish Pledge changes that.
I hope that it allows us to be able to be successful with a little less work than we're currently doing. And then obviously to make use of all of this natural resource is a big thing. And then I hope it's lucrative.
Lucrative for the fisheries and for the Grand Traverse Band, which is talking about developing a liquid fertilizer with the fish parts. So far, about 25 businesses in the Great Lakes have signed on to the 100% Fish Pledge. Their goal is to find ways to use all parts of the fish by next year. For NPR News, I'm Dan Wanshura in Leland, Michigan.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Stay tuned for a political breakdown after the KQED News Quiz and after KQED traffic, starting with a new problem in San Jose. Here's Julie Depesh.
We're heading northbound on 280 before Saratoga Avenue. The two right lanes taken away. It's a four-car pileup. Injuries of all tier and a backup to the 880-17 interchange. And then close by, northbound 280 before Bird Avenue. That's a three-car wreck. Right lane block there with brake lights from 7th Street. There was some earlier trouble on the East Shore car fire. So eastbound 80 is sluggish about 52 minutes from Emeryville to the Carquinez Bridge. Julie for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. Okay, it's now time for the KQED News Quiz Question of the Day, sponsored by Canyon Ranch Woodside. Today's question is, Fresh Air last night spent the hour with what groundbreaking New Yorker magazine investigative reporter? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio news quiz for a chance to enter to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside.
American cowboys are synonymous with the Wild West. Dusty towns, desert plains, tumbleweeds. But a group of cowboys in Louisiana say that picture is incomplete.
Our culture, black culture and Creole culture in America has redefined what it means to be a cowboy.
We tag along on a trail ride through rural Louisiana. Saddle up for All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekend All Things Considered starts at 5 p.m. Today on our local news podcast, The Bay, California's in the middle of figuring out how it wants to regulate artificial intelligence. We're going to hear how those efforts are going and how AI could affect us all. That's on The Bay. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's KQED News. I'm Tara Seiler. In a week where both former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris stumped for cash in California, there are signs of a growing split among Democrats over President Biden's new crackdown of migrants seeking asylum at the southern border. On today's Political Breakdown, host Scott Schaefer talks with KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati and Politico senior political reporter Melanie Mason about how the issue could play out in November.
Guy, let me begin with you. This order that President Biden signed in front of a big sign saying securing the border, kind of summarize it for us.
Yeah, so this is going to prohibit most people from asylum protections if they cross the southern border without inspection, so if they don't go through port of entry. But I think the key piece of this, and Biden even acknowledged this in his press conference, is there's, this is not coming with new funding like that potential bipartisan bill that did not get to the finish line. This is not coming with new money for judges or for immigration workers to actually speed up the process. And so you have this massive exception in this executive order for what they call operational constraints. And I think we could possibly see that reality where there simply just aren't enough. I mean, the best estimates I've seen, there might need to be double the number of immigration judges in the system just to clear the backlog we have in the next 10 years. So it, for all intents and purposes, you could end up with just an overloaded system that exists today without more resources. And so at that point, it's hard to really decipher what is the policy gains made by this order.
And so the order, I think, says that if there is for 7 consecutive days, 2,500 or more migrants crossing at these illegal entries.
But we're there.
Right. And so when he signed it, we were there. And so it did shut it down. But there's also exceptions for kids who are being trafficked and for unaccompanied children and probably adults who are being trafficked as well. So another loophole that, could make this a little leaky.
Right. Well, there are those exceptions. And I think that's what a lot of supporters of this measure have said differentiates it from very similar orders that President Trump, when he was president, tried and ultimately failed to execute because it was struck down in the courts. This would also, though, make it harder for folks who are trying to seek ways to stay here through means beyond asylum to actually do that, add new restrictions, raise some standards in the interview process. So, I think we can get into the politics here of why Biden did this now, but I do think the politics looms large when you think about what kind of impact this will actually have on migration.
Well, let's talk about the politics, Melanie. Obviously, there's been a split. You wrote about it among Democrats. Give us a sense of how it breaks down.
I mean, I think first, let's just take a pull back for a second in terms of, like, there used to be this line from Democrats, which is, you know, we're okay with border security, clamping down on border security, but we need to see in exchange these more comprehensive immigration reform packages, which includes this path to citizenship, relief for Dreamers, you know, better, expansion or at least administration of asylum for all of the issues that Guy pointed out. And what we've seen, both in this executive order and in the deal that had been negotiated and then fell apart in Congress a few months earlier, is that Democrats sort of said, all right, look, we will give on the border protection without getting those things in return. That's a huge political shift. And so I think then what you're seeing in the divide among Democrats is some Democrats who are getting behind this shift, who say, okay, we need to sort of, we're getting hammered on looking like we're weak on the border, so we need to sort of give on this border protection side and maybe not get these things that we've been waiting decades for. And then there's others like Senator Alex Padilla who are saying, why are we abandoning these principles, which we have been sticking with for so long? And so I think this is the core tension, because Democrats are abandoning this sort of trade position that has been the anchor of their immigration policy for so long.
Well, and Guy, Padilla in a statement really slammed the executive order as having, quoting here, undermined American values and abandoned our nation's obligations to provide people fleeing persecution, violence, and authoritarianism. He's not up for re-election. Neither is LaFonza Butler, the senator who was appointed. And yet you really see very divergent points of view here on this policy. And interestingly, the mayor of San Diego, Todd Gloria, who is really on the front lines of all this, also supporting the president's action.
Padilla said President Biden has undermined American values. I have not heard him make a statement like that against the president before. I think it speaks to the divisions that Melanie talks about and just the whiplash on this issue and how quickly the politics of it have changed for Democrats. I mean, if you go back to 2018 and you look at President Trump's executive order that tried to do similar things, you know, restrict asylum claims to ports of entry, the amicus brief in the lawsuit that ultimately took down that executive order, the top name on the amicus brief, Javier Becerra, Attorney General of California. And to see now the governor of California standing behind Biden's order, yes, I know there's more exceptions there. It's not exactly the same, but it just shows how much this has shifted. And in part because during the Trump years, Democratic voters did move so far to the left on immigration that it put the party in this really kind of precarious position now that immigration has emerged as an issue that it just wasn't in 2020.
Yeah, Melanie, what do you make of that? The fact that, Democrats have always been very pro-migrant, very pro-immigration. And as Guy said, and we have to have border security as well. That was always like very much secondary. And so this shift is they're just playing defense, right? They're seeing the polls. They're hearing people like Mayor Eric Adams in New York, the governor of Illinois saying, hey, we can't handle this.
The most interesting element to me about this is that there was this fundamental assumption among Democrats that part of their core coalition were voters of color, particularly Latinos, right? And that the idea was that in order to appeal to Latino voters, you had to have this very liberal approach on immigration. I mean, to your point, Guy, 2018 is a great example. 2019, the Democratic primary for president is another. All these candidates were racing so far to the left to propose things like making it not a criminal offense to cross the border without sort of legal permission to do so. I mean, that's how far to the left, because there was an assumption that the Democratic coalition needed to see that. And what we're seeing is poll after poll shows that these core voters, these Latino voters, there might be more of a divide than was originally assumed. We are seeing things like an Axios poll that came out a couple months ago that shows that Latino voters overwhelmingly support border security. I mean, that is there is still a break, I think, between Latino voters and white voters about whether there's a, you know, immigrants are a net positive for society. Latino voters are more likely to say that. But that doesn't mean that Latino voters don't also want to see border security. One of the key reasons for this shift is that Latino voters are, you know, getting generations further and further away from being recent immigrants. Now, in California, there's still a sizable population of first-generation immigrants, which is why Senator Alex Padilla's position makes a lot of sense. But even the number of new registrations among voters between who's firstborn between 2002 and 2022 went from something like 54% were first-generation new registrants to 9%. I mean, we are seeing just a massive assimilation of the Latino voters into the voters at large. And because of that, their politics on border security are changing.
Yeah, and of course, we're now quite a ways out from Proposition 187, which was on the ballot in 1994. And we saw a big shift of Latinos toward the Democrats. And it might just be that we're in something of a post-Prop 187 environment where things are really changing.
That was KQED's Scott Schaefer, Guy Marzorati, and Politico senior political reporter Melody Mason. You can hear the rest of their conversation on the Political Breakdown podcast. I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
San Mateo Bridge is not the place to be right now. Julie Depesch will be here with details in less than a minute. Support for NPR comes from USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses turn shipping into an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. From Smart Mouth, committed to the prevention of bad breath for 24 hours with zinc ion technology. Smart Mouth products can be found nationwide at drugstores, grocery stores, and supercenters, or at smartmouth.com.